the open windows to listen and clap their hands. And all of a sudden, some cousin of the family said, "Irene, go in the bathroom. The cops are at the window."
I ran to the bathroom.
And my hostess said, "Where's Irene?" And they said, "She's in the bathroom." And they said, "Take her out of the bathroom. I won't have her hiding from anybody in this house." And she said, "Look at the cops out there. They're smiling. They're enjoying the music." And however, I was very careful to keep out of the way so that I couldn't be seen from the outside. It's very interesting that when I first came to stay with this woman, she was terribly frightened that the house would be bombed, and she had me hiding and kept the shades down all the time, and I walked in and out like a fugitive. But as the days wore on, she committed herself more and more until this incident where she made me come out of hiding even though the cops were outside. It indicates how commitment works. What was I going to say? These men who were part of the sextet came right off their jobs, and they were in their working clothes and sweating, and sweat standing on their foreheads and the cords of their necks standing out. They were singing with such intensity and passion that I just sat there transfixed. Any other singing that I'll ever hear after this would be seem like a castration. It was just a singing from the very bowels of these men. It was no more than an artistic effort. It was indescribable.
Clyde had been to the hospital. I stayed there 5 or 6 days with him when he was operating on the floor.
They didn't tell why. Well, now you know, if the body of a month and a half or six and a half, he was to go to be checked. And the first time he was to go back there and check on our men, Miss Hudson.
Yes.
And Clyde was with him. Was just his kidney too. But when he went back, it wasn't long. You see, when who in the world is studying about me? And Clyde was laying in the bed, you know, in the hall. I don't think you ever been to parts of you know how well they're headed off the blue rooms and his alley comes out. So he raised up in the bed where he could see. And when he looked and he says, "That's my mother and my sister." Well, we asked the ward, the man that we have to ask to see. He says, "Who do you want to see?" He says, "Clyde and all." He says, "Clyde is sick." I say, "He is sick, yes." I says, "Well, can you see him?" The guest said, "You just go on out and sit down and see who brings." And they hope him to get in his clothes, and one man on one side and one on the other support them, drag his feet out to where we were and stand. And he sat there and cried and talked and cried and talked. And I had sent him, he wrote me to send him some cornflakes, some milk, and sugar. I sent him these tall cans of condensed milk and sent him six big boxes of cornflakes. And he said, "Mama, I still was glad to get that, what you sent me." And he says, "I could use some of it now." But he said, "They won't give me nothing to eat if I can't go get it. They won't let none of them bring it in to me." I said, "Well, what do they expect?" And again on the 12th, and they let him come back. And we went back on the 13th, and they kept him. They put him to bed. And began to give him blood transfusion, and first one thing, and then another, and such that thing, and then another. And he thought probably he would get able to come back home, but he didn't. He just kept, you know, gradually going,
and
gradually.
And ironically, what was the day he died on?
July 4th.
On the birthday of the station.
That's right. 4th of July.
Died. Then
about 7:30.
And his body was brought back here.
I stayed right there, and they, see, Clyde had, see, the hospital was nearby, connected with the school, you know, the same school he went to.
Yes.
And he had so many friends there.
Yes.
We stayed there. He died on a Friday evening. And we stayed there, and they got his body ready. And they had a funeral for him.
In Chicago.
In Chicago.
But his final funeral was here.
Was here.
At the Mary Magdalene Church.
We stayed there. Bed, right there. We stayed there. They had his funeral on a Sunday. We left at Monday morning.
Yes.
Before, well, we got that, what is that train, early train comes out? City of New Orleans.
Yes.
That's it. And we got that, the undertaker got his body over there, and we got there and left about 8:30. And we got in Jackson about 9.
And then he was...
The undertaker from here in Hattiesburg met the body in Jackson.
Yes.
And my son-in-law and my son and daughter-in-law met me and my daughter and another girl, Miss Birdie, met us there, and so we came on home, and they kept him until Wednesday, and they departed.
We went to see
cemetery.
Cemetery, and it's tragic that your son, being the man that he was, lies there without a tombstone or even a marker.
Now you see, when they fixed his body up in Chicago, and I have this flag here and everything. Now the government was to have done put that thing.
Why
I don't know.
The federal government was going to put a
tombstone. It's
young man contributes an oblique criticism of Russia. Ever since the American aggression, he says, the revisionists, meaning the Soviets, have not dared to protest. This man is the group leader, a crucial figure in the national campaign of mass persuasion. He is the link with central authority. Professor Doak Barnett has made this observation about the study groups. The individual must think, but he does not think independently. His mind is shaped by the pressures within the group. The Chinese communists have hit upon a method of indoctrination that reveals great intuitive insight into subtle psychological principles. A Chinese editor who participated in these sessions says, you can't think clearly. You realize that your real thoughts will someday pop out of your mouth. To be safe, you have to change your real thoughts or not think at all. Essential to the study program is that these probing discussions invariably end where they begin. The propaganda hours, propaganda inserts itself.
Venerated.
Yan'an is a shrine, a place where the young can study topographical maps of the Long March, where they can be reminded of Mao's leadership, his strategy, his defeat of the nationalists, the birth of Red China. The young who have no direct experience of revolution are thus kept aware of it. For a long time, Mao derided the cult of personality, the public adulation of leaders. But as part of the great process of mass persuasion, the need to assure every Chinese that all decisions by Peking are right, recent years have seen an elevation of Mao to what is close to divinity. Listen to this report by a committee of Peking professors. Chairman Mao has comprehensively, systematically, and creatively developed Marxism-Leninism in the direction of politics, economics, law, history, literature, art, language, philosophy, military science, and diplomacy. The thought of Mao Zedong is extremely expansive and profound. It is the compass for any and all tasks. With it, one knows the correct direction. Without it, all is lost. He's also referred to as the sun, benefactor, savior, father, northern star, searchlight, balsam tree, and it has retained its... This one tells of the Battle of Yan'an. The old man in white is a peasant whom the Kuomintang have forced to guide them to the Reds. He deceives them by leading them in circles, and he is beaten. The villains are nationalist officers or Americans, or various running dogs of the imperialists. The reformed opera is a fairly new form. The magazine Peking Review, in reporting a new opera about the Korean War, reveals that they are only a year or so old. Apparently, their producers were worried about popular acceptance at first, but the worries, the magazine's opera critic says, were groundless.
Yeah. because I didn't think it was right. I was on my way to work, and he was probably just going uptown to do some shopping. So I went and get up and give him my seat. And Tuesday, we had another accident on the bus. And not very important is riding the bus, because Negro people here support the bus, especially the ladies. The bus be full of ladies every morning. Bus I ride, it be nearly as many standing, it is sitting down. And bus driver asked this girl, she sit beside a white guy. He asked the girl to get up. She said, no. She said, I paid my dime and I'm going to ride the bus. So we asked her again to get up. And she said, she refused to get up. So he gets up out of his seat and grabs her arm and tries to pull off in the bus. So she taking her umbrella and she tried to hit him with it. He hit my leg and that stopped that. So she bit him. She stretched.
The cop's car and got in from the other side. And he talked about knocking me in the head, you know.
Uh-huh.
And he arrested you.
And he arrested me. And then after we got to jail, they locked me up. And one policeman came back and he questioned me and asked me some questions about my family and my kids. And then he left. Another policeman came back later, and he asked me to come up front. And so I went up front, and then they said that the city commission had ordered them to release me, and without bond. And so then they read the subpoena to me, and they gave it to me, and I left. And you've been charged with a felony, is that right? A charge with resisting an officer and holding it, and having a concealed weapon. Is that what you were charged with?
Yes, ma'am. Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Mrs. Jackson. How many children have you?
I have four.
Four children. And do you work?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
This is Sandra Addix, who's one of our Capable Freedom School teachers here in Hattiesburg. She has just been arrested.
Oh, yeah.
She has just been arrested for trying to integrate the public library in Hattiesburg. I'll have her tell her story.
Well, actually, I wasn't arrested for trying to integrate the public library. In the course of our discussion at Freedom School, the kids have mentioned all the things that they can't do. They can't go to integrated to white high schools. They can't go to the public library. And it was their idea that since the Civil Rights Bill has passed, one of the things they certainly should be allowed to do is go to the library in town, since all the taxes the people pay for that library. So it was their decision that today would be a good day for us to go to the library. They wanted to get library cards. And we left. Oh, excuse me, just a minute. We went to the library, and we walked up to the desk, and this girl was standing on the telephone, and she took one look at us, and we could see her eyes just sort of dance out of her head. She was on the telephone, and when she finished that call, she called quickly someplace and said, "Will you tell so-and-so, somebody, to come up here quickly?" So we approached the desk, and she said, "Can I help you all?" And the girl said, "Well, yes, we'd like library cards." And she said, "Well, I'm sorry, we're not issuing library cards to you. Have you tried the 6th Street Library? That's the segregated library in town." And the girl said, "Yes, we have, but they don't have the books we want there." So she said, "Well, I'm very sorry, we can't issue cards to you, and we'll have to close the library if you stay here." And just then this other woman she'd called came up, and the woman said, "Yes, may I help you?" And the girls repeatedly, there was one boy that couldn't sex with. The girls repeated the request and they wanted to take out library cards. And the woman began by saying something like, "Look, I'm a Yankee and I'm sympathetic and I'm unsympathetic. You don't really want library cards at all because I spent a whole month down at 6th Street and nobody came in there." And the girl said, "Well, they don't have any books down there." And that it was better to have injustice than to have the libraries closed. She said, "I can't put you out, but if you stay here, I'll have to call the police and we'll have to close the library." And the students at all times were courteous and just said, "Well, we still don't understand why we can't have a library card. This is a public library, and we'd like to have a card here." And at one point she said, "Look, will you close your mouths and open your minds, or will you act intelligent, or will you stop interrupting me?" And they never at any time were rude or never at any time interrupted her. So the upshot was, she said, the only thing I had to say to her was, "Do you realize that it's the law of the land that they should be allowed to have a library, that they should be able to use this facility?" And she said, "Yes, we know all about that." And then she said to them, "Are you going to stay here, or shall I have to call the police?" So I asked them, I turned to them and I said, "What is your choice?" And Jamela Stokes said, "If we can't use it, we feel that nobody should be able to use the library." So we sat down at the table, and the woman made several phone calls, and we were reading magazines. After about 20 minutes, the police chief came in. I was told that it's Jamela Stokes, who was the chief of police. He came
came over to me and he said, "Are you the leader?" And I said, "No, I'm not the leader. I'm a friend of these girls." And he said, "Well, get out. We're closing the library." So I went outside. He did go around to everybody and said, "We're closing the library." We waited outside on the curb to make sure that indeed the library was closed, not just us, but everybody. And everybody did come out, and the police chief said, "Don't worry. They're closing the library."
We went to deal that afternoon with Watson, but one adult in the number, and that was me.
Really? Was that back in January? Was this on voter registration?
This was April the 10th.
April the 10th. Was it a picket line for voter registration?
That's right. That's what it was, a picket line for that. And we were marching, so we went to the picket line. And we marched. We were marching that day with our backs to the courthouse door. We were going from the courthouse, coming around. With WBKH. Was sitting on the sidewalk waiting.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the reporters put his head inside the car and said, "Here come them niggas."
Mm-hmm.
And Clyde came back, "Don't bother."
Mm-hmm.
So we continued to march. They let us march around and around. And the next thing I knew, I saw the cheering taking a straight march going down side the courthouse, going to the jail,
mm-hmm.
going to the county jail. And I didn't hear them tell us who were under arrest. What I heard them say, "Well, you're marching so well this way. Now you march that way."
Uh-huh.
But if they tell us we were under arrest, they told us like that. So I began to see the cheering falling in line. I was way back on the rear end of the march. And there was one little boy who was with us. He was a very eloquent little boy. His name is Curtis Duckworth.
Uh-huh.
He was a junior.
Oh, really?
And he was with the number. So when we got to the county jail, they marched this little boy off to the side. Before he got there, they would run up and down the line to all those teenagers and ask them, "How old is you?" And they would tell them something or other. And the next one would say, "How old is you?" But they never did ask me one time. They never did ask me how old I were outdoors.
Mm-hmm.
So when we got inside the jail house, oh, he cussed those picket signs. When we had on our necks and toes, put those so-and-so things over there in that box, and I mean, put them in there now. I took my time and pulled mine off. Took my time and walked to the box and put it over in the box and stood up. Well, it comes, you know, searching the church, patting them all down, just patting them all over. The little girls, they came to me, they said, "Miss Lee, say, she gonna let that man pet you?" Ooh, when she asked me that, I says, "I clap for all the heavenly living gods that made me. He ain't gonna pet me then." I said, "You know why? It's a Negro woman and he's a white man." I said, "You'll not pet me then." But then he looked at me and I looked right at him. If he didn't say a word to me, I'd say one to him. After a while, when my turn came, he says, "Mary, what do you have on you?" I says, "I don't have anything on me." I said, "My medicine is in my pocketbook is down that cap. You won't get that." He told me I wouldn't get my medicine until I was out of jail. So I whirled around. I said, "Thank you." Up the stairway I went. Went on up there and unlocked the cell and they marched us in. We were sitting down on the bed. The children were sitting on the bed and we began to sing. "We shall overcome," sang it. "Soft and loaded." All right. The jailer came running up the steps. He was cussing. He came in there and he took his hand and he pounded Linda Wilson's side of her head just as hard as he could knock her because she was saying.
Oh.
He knocked her over because she was saying, "We shall overcome." Well, another little old constable named Wilmer Kitchen. He came a running, took him, saying, "Let him get me." That time I got up. Looked right in his face. And that was something I had never did in my life. Grit my teeth. I didn't know how, but I was gritting my teeth so hard. And I looked at him. When he looked at me and saw me look at him so hard, he dropped his head. Dropped his hands down to his side and he walked out. Well, they locked us up. We stayed in there. The next morning was Saturday morning. That was 11 away. They sent up for me. She said, "Are you going?" I said, "Well, sure, I'm going." I said, "I haven't did anything." I said, "If they ask me something I know, I'll tell them, and if I don't, I'll tell them I don't know." I saw two well-dressed men standing near me. I knew there wasn't any people in heaven with me because they had too pleasant an expression on the face. So.
Too pleasant?
Yeah, too pleasant a look on the face, but if any of those people in heaven were, I knew they were out-of-town people when I saw them. So I went on down and he told me good morning. I said, good morning. He says, how are you feeling this morning? I said, well, I could have felt better if I would have gotten my medicine. I said, I suffered my gallbladder and they wouldn't let me have my medicine. He said, you mean to tell me they wouldn't let you have your medicine? I said, no, they did not. He said, well, come on. One on one side and one on the other. He says, no one to hurt you, no one to harass you. We want some information. So I went on in the room and I began to tell him the ins and outs of how everything were operating. I told him we were sitting on the bed and this jailer knocked this girl over because we were singing. And we were singing soul. Well, he told me just go ahead on and outline it. The first thing they did, they went in their coat and brought out those little cards. And he says, I'm FBI 2. That one was redheaded. Mm-hmm. And the next one says, I'm FBI Chop.
Prayer meeting that morning, and we had song service.
one of the trustees up there and told us to cut out that so-and-so singing. He was cutting. Cut out that so-and-so singing. So, the girls, they all got amazed over it. But then Lula Sim went to the doorway and told him that she wouldn't let him tell her how to serve her God, not to save his life. Everybody began to get upstairs, you know. He came back. We wouldn't stop singing. He told me we wasn't going to stop. He told me if we didn't stop that so-and-so singing, we wouldn't get any done. So we told him we ain't going to stop. We sure ain't going to stop singing this time if we don't sing. Well, he see, it looked so bad. He went back and came up there and they told us if we didn't shut our mouths, he'd go back down there and get his gun and come back and kill us. And they all got red and he ran up and he spit in some of those girls' faces. And they come back crying, telling me about his spit in the face. And I told him, I said, well, now look, we are friends in Jesus Christ. I said, he spit in his face. I said, now is the time, if you don't know the Lord, now is the time for you to find him. I said, because I didn't come to jail looking for no living room, no dining room, no bedroom, no easy chairs, no TVs, and nothing. I said, I prayed to the Lord if that would wake up. Kelly's part of our people is about singing about help fight the rewrite. So I said, I prayed George James. I said, I'm not worried. I said, I wasn't looking for anything. And those nasty beds that we lied on, what we was on for sheets was newspaper. When those boys would read that paper, we would ask them for them because we didn't have anything, you know, to lie on. So we asked them for the paper and they would give us their newspaper. Spread it on our beat. So that Friday night, they jailed. It was three girls already in jail when we went in there. And five of us went in there. And they jailed. Two ladies that night was pregnant. And I told the little children, I said, all of us get on this bed. I said, let those ladies have one bed here by herself, and the other one over there have one bed. So all those children now be sitting on the bed. All of us got on one bed and give those ladies a bed to lie down on. So what they were lying on was newspaper. That's what we had, newspaper. And what they would give us for supper was one square of cornbread and a cup of skim milk. That square of cornbread is about 3 inches square and about an inch thick. That's what we had for supper. Well, in the morning time, they would give us grits with a big pat of oleo over in and about 2 tablespoons of syrup in a little old tin pan. If you drank coffee, you could have coffee. Other than that, if you didn't drink coffee, you didn't get anything. That's where it fed us. So on the 15th day of April, well, that Wednesday, at the time we wouldn't stop singing. We just sang right on. And after a while, when I heard this lady telling him about serving her God, when I knew anything, I was standing up. You know, the Holy Spirit just rained down on me, and I found myself, I was standing up, talking out to women. And I told the jailer down there, I said, you don't have any food down there. I said, that's God's food. He's just letting you be overseer over it. I said, but you don't have any food to keep giving nobody. You don't have any. I said, that's God's food. Talked on and on and on after a while. When the dinner got ready, he sent us in. He got the oldest people were up there. We had a lady in there who was 71 years of age. He got the oldest one and went down and he did something that had never been done. And that was invited us from up in the cell down on the street floor to the kitchen to eat like human beings. Our food just passed out through the window. So they went down and they were so hurt they couldn't eat. They came back. He sent back and he got the next troop. The next oldest troop. And they went down. They couldn't eat. So when he sent for me, he had them said he wouldn't feed them devilish youngers to save their life. So when he sent for me, I told him I wouldn't eat a mile of that food down there to save his life. I said, you don't feed them children, you won't feed me. I said, because none of us have given you anything.
What was it that impelled you, or an older woman, to
to risk going to jail, to willingly go to jail and walk on the picket line, what was your life like that made you feel it was necessary and you wanted to?
We didn't have the opportunity to do and to go places in the time of the land of the freedom and land of the brave, and I couldn't see it.